Good morning. You're listening to Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. Today, we're talking about the stigma that can surround mental illness and addiction. Joining us, we have Hannah Heimbach of the Bearded Sister, a local recovery group. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we also have Jay Bechtel, CEO of South Peninsula Behavioral Health Services. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks, Renee.
And if you want to join the conversation, you can call 299-235-7721 or email us at info@kbbi.org. And let's just talk broadly here. What do we mean when we say stigma? What are some of the stereotypes or negative attitudes towards people with mental illness or addiction?
Well, that's a good question, a good place to start. First off, I'd like to say thanks for having us in. This is May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're glad we snuck in just under the wire on this one to talk about this. So stigma is one of those things that, and stereotype is the word that you used, I believe. And basically what that is, it's identifying some things that you have seen or heard or read about and pushing them out over everybody. And what happens with stigma is you become, the person is identified as that characteristic or that behavior without recognizing them as a person. And therefore, they're no longer people. They're just a symptom. They're an incident. They're a behavior. They're a disease. For most illnesses, you describe people with an illness as saying, oh, my brother-in-law is struggling with cancer. My brother-in-law is fighting with cancer. With mental illness or substance abuse, you often find people saying, oh, my sister is bipolar. You describe them as the disease. And that doesn't happen with a lot of things. And that is very stigmatizing. To turn a person into a disease is can be very harmful.
And the way that that often takes shape in the experience for the person that is struggling or for their family is that results in this assumption that the disease is a moral failing. And that it's something that is the result of bad choices, bad behavior, and that really erases a lot of the qualities of the disease that we know about medically.
And so what are the ways that we should, look at mental illness and addiction in a healthy way, in a different way, you know, not as a moral failing, not as just the disease? How do we keep the person, you know, in this?
You keep the person in it. That's what you have to do. The idea behind stigma is you put that on people over there. Those people over there are that way. That person acts that way. When you know people that struggle with addiction or mental illness, when you know people that are showing symptoms, it changes your perspective. And that's one of the things that helps. If you can identify it, name it, and talk about it openly, it takes a lot of that, like anything, it takes a lot of that stigma right away.
Hannah? Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, the biggest thing we can do is talk about it. I think that that's one of the impacts of stigma is the shame surrounding those issues often creates a culture of silence. And that creates a huge barrier to care for the people that are struggling with those issues, and then also for their families and their friends that are also experiencing trauma and impacts from those diseases. So being honest and giving ourselves within our families, within our communities and friend groups, permission to be honest and tell those stories, not only about how we're struggling, but also when we recover. You know, I'm really happy to be living in long-term recovery from alcohol addiction. And I made a conscious choice to share that.
How long have you been in recovery?
Just over 6 years.
That's great. And how long were you struggling with the disease before you got into recovery?
From the time I started drinking, probably when I was 15 years old. So over a decade.
Yeah. It's so interesting because a lot of the frustration or stigma that comes out of these diseases is so old. I mean, it goes back to, you know, before there was mental illness. People with alcohol or mental illness problems were identified as demonic or possessed or scary. And that difference just continues to permeate, that somehow the person's behavior has created them to be this different. When reality is, it's like any other disease. There is a physiological imbalance somewhere in your body that makes you more susceptible to certain inputs. And that's all diseases are. And So it's interesting the way the stigma carries on as being something that the person does rather than a disease.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, how they can often compound each other. You know, for me, and I know for a lot of other people struggling with alcohol, I started with depression and anxiety from childhood, and being unwilling to cope with that in a way that was healthy, you know, I turned to other things, and understandably it snowballed from there. But
yeah, exactly right. And if, not saying it would have prevented you, but certainly, certainly if there had been someone, a doctor, a teacher, someone in your life earlier on that said, you know, it looks like you're having some of these symptoms of depression or anxiety, let's get you in and talk to somebody and see if we can help mitigate some of those. Maybe at some point you don't have that first sip of alcohol in reaction, or maybe you do, and maybe it ends up a little differently.
Right. Yeah, you know, we can't look back and predict what would have happened. And I think often we can get in our own way because of the assumptions we make about ourselves, because of that greater societal narrative that we've heard about people like us. Oh, well, I've heard about people that are addicted. I've heard about people that are depressed. I don't want to be like that. So I need to deal with it privately, silently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there's when you're talking about stigma, there's the stigma that society places on people. But what you're talking about also is the stigma people place on themselves.
Definitely.
There's certainly in the United States a need to take care of yourself. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You make yourself, you're the person you made yourself into.
That's right.
And when you are unable, because of an illness, to do that effectively, instead of getting help for that, you hide it and try harder to pull yourself up. Mm-hmm. And the harder you try to pull yourself up, the more pressure it puts on you. And as you fail, then you go into these other, your symptoms increase, your need for a substance increases, and you're stuck in a cycle.
And often when people get to the point with their mental illness, with their addiction, that they are willing to get help or desperate enough to get help or forced to get help, it has progressed to a point that is truly chaotic.
It's stage 5 cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can you guys, you know, you're already talking about it, but can you say more about, you know, what a culture of stigma means for people who are struggling with this, struggling with diseases? I mean, what do you see as the effects?
I mean, initially, it means living in secrecy. I think that's one of the most wonderful parts of my sober life is that I feel free of this secret. And I can tell the truth about who I am, the good, bad, and ugly.
Was there a thing somewhere along the way that got you out of that secrecy? Or do you remember attempts of your own or someone around you to pull you out of that secrecy?
There was a lot of attempts, and I think there often are with people. For me, it was finally making a connection to something inside myself that was hopeful, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly what triggered that, but that definitely inspires a lot of my approach to recovery today and to sharing. The reason I share my recovery is that I think too often we hear about the negatives of the addiction and the diseases. But I didn't hear a lot of stories about people that recovered. I was blind to them in part. But my hope is that I can share that out and help people realize that there is another path that's possible.
Yeah, I think that's a good message.
Jay, what do you see for people that come into the center as what took them out of secrecy, or what, you know, was the thing that allowed them to sort of get over that stigma and get help?
Well, I think like Hannah said, sometimes it's not so clear and sometimes you don't have any choice. You have lost your job. You've lost your family. The court has said you have to go there. I mean, there's a number of reasons. What would be ideal is if people were, when they were 7 years old and they sat down and talked with their doctor, the doctor said, here are some things you might have to worry about in your life because of the history of your family. So keep an eye out for alcoholism, keep an eye out for mental illness, keep an eye out for asthma, keep an eye out for prostate cancer. These are the different, they're all health issue problems. So when people finally come into the center, generally they're coming in because they've been referred by someone. And that's unfortunate. It would be lovely if everyone that's listening or that's struggling or that's just having a regular day said, you know what, it might be time for a checkup, and just wandered in. not just to the center, but to a therapist, to a hospital, to whatever they could find, and just get a checkup and say, here's my history, here's what I'm doing now, here's the things that concern me, here's the things that are great, and really use your mental health as a continuum. Everyone has mental health problems from time to time, and it's just a matter of how bad they get and how impactful they are on your life. I have stressful days, and my wife and kids don't want to talk, my staff don't want to talk to me. I don't blame them. I'm a horrible person on those days. And if those mental illness conditions and symptoms continue to get worse in that manner, then it can be very impactful on my relationship with my family, my relationship with my peers, my relationship with my friends. If I do things to manage those behaviors, find someone to talk to, know what my coping skills are. My coping skills are puzzles and television. I find those help soothe me, wind me down. You find those things that help manage your mental illness symptoms, and you implement them. Then you can come into the center, you can come into your therapist and say, here's what I'm doing, good, check it off, and you're moving on about your life. So I don't know if I answered your question, I got a little sidetracked there, but certainly, there's another one of my mental illnesses, I ramble. I'm sorry.
And what I'm hearing from you guys too is the earlier the better, to not let disease grow in secrecy.
That's right. So I was talking with a friend in town who has a family member with substance abuse disorder. And she said when her kids were 4 and 5, she started talking with them about the substance use in their family. Completely takes it out of the closet, puts it on the table, makes it clear that here's something in our life. Not to be scared of, not to threaten you. It's not the boogeyman. It's just something that's in your life. And if you can talk about it openly and honestly and clearly starting at that early age, it takes a lot of that stigma away because they're comfortable talking about it. For some reason in my family, my grandfather and grandmother were alcoholic. I just did it. I identified my grandparents as a disease. How about that? I chalk it up. But anyway, and my father talked to my sister and I when we were kids and said, your grandparents struggle with this and you need to be careful. Not you're bad if you do it, not you're damned if you do it. You just need to be careful. And I'm not sure where he got that insight to do it. Maybe his own struggles being the child of a parent with alcoholism, but it really helped. Those conversations go a long way towards improving the outcome and educating people on what needs to be done. I don't know, Hannah, if you have some other thoughts.
I think that's really true. And while you were saying that, I was also thinking about, you know, people that are already struggling and either want to talk to their families or their children about it, have concerns. You know, one thing we talk a lot about is what do you replace it with? You know, because a lot early on we learn coping mechanisms with our illnesses, with our addictions that look completely normal in other people. You know, drinking is a great example of that. I think that society often tells us that this is the way you relax, relieve stress. This is how we celebrate. This is how we experience all of our emotions, anger, happiness, excitement. And when you take away that that piece, we need something to replace it with. But there's a lot of great things to replace it with. That's just not always the dominant narrative. So, you know, having a narrative in your family of how we celebrate and how we experience emotion that doesn't revolve around around substances is great. And sometimes we have to actually work hard to do that, considering a lot of the different messages that are out there.
It is a challenge, and mm-hmm. It just takes practice. The more you practice it, the better chance you have of using it when you need to.
Mm-hmm. Do you both have tips for how to talk about it? I mean, for people out there who are like, ooh, I want to, but this makes me really anxious, and I don't know if I'm saying the right, you know, words or talking about it in the correct way. Do you have some advice?
I think you just have to be honest. Speak to your experience and not try to analyze someone else's experience. You know, that's a good rule of thumb. And find other people that are. I mean, the best thing I ever did was find another group of alcoholics that wanted to get better. Mm-hmm. You know, so being just direct and honest about what you're experiencing and giving other people around you the permission to do the same thing, because at the end of the day, these diseases know no type of person, no demographic, no family group. And you will always find people that have experienced those things or have a close person to them that has.
I think Hannah's right. Talking openly about it is the best way. And being okay with being wrong. There's nothing wrong with me approaching Hannah and say, hey, so alcoholic, huh? And her going, well, I prefer the term substance abuse. Oh, okay, now I know. And those conversations are perfectly fine. There's no way you're going to be politically and medically correct with everything you say. But being open to making mistakes and being open to being wrong is fine, as long as you are doing it openly and honestly, because then that facilitates a conversation. Instead of placing a blame or placing a label on someone, it makes it much easier to have that human-to-human, person-to-person conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's part of kind of chipping away at this culture of silence we have around these things. We have to be willing to be just a little uncomfortable, you know, a little awkward. I think privacy and anonymity is important, and that's a personal choice, and I respect that and everybody out there. You know, I choose to talk about it because that's important to me, and I want to share my experience, but I do that imperfectly, and that's okay.
And I, as we've already heard today, I do it much more imperfectly as well.
And as we've talked about, I mean, these diseases affect everybody. Everybody, you know, can go through these. But are there some identities that, you know, stigma can affect more than others? You know, I was thinking about depression, you know, does gender affect, you know, how much you feel stigma? Do men see, you know, more stigma for depression than women? Are there some, you know, is age or gender or ethnicity affect stigma at all?
There have been books written on different diseases and their impact on men, women, age, kids, ethnic populations. So yes, there's plenty of research on that. Anecdotally, you will see that there are some diseases that I think are more acceptable for women to have. Women can be depressed. It's okay. Women get depressed. We understand. Oh, it's okay. When men get depressed, it's what's wrong. Oh, men don't get depressed. Men have to be men can be angry and alcoholic. That's manly. You know, so it's there are some of those kinds of things that make it more okay in our culture to be those things. But there is not. There is no. If you have a brain, you are susceptible to a disease. It's that simple.
Yeah, it really is. You know, from my experience, I experienced age kind of as a discriminating factor in a kind of a curious way. You know, I got sober in my mid to late 20s, and anybody that was in my immediate circle understood that was the right choice. You know, I needed to go down that path, and I'm glad I did. But just a step away from that chaos, I encountered so many people that said, ah, well, you're young. We all did it. And I'm sure that you'll be able to drink. You know, you could have one. And there was this sweet as it was, this desire to give me permission because I was young to party and to just let loose a little bit. And I think that was kind in some ways, and in other ways allowed me to ignore the very serious physiological issue I had, which was a very chronic, serious addiction.
So that stereotype of, yeah, when you're young, you know, everybody's drinks was actually a barrier to seeing this as a problem.
Right. I mean, at least in my personal interpretation of it, it often seemed like, oh, I should be able to do this. I am young. I can cut loose. This isn't strange or damaging, you know, but it was.
And at the same time, what that shows is there was people around that wanted to help to a certain degree. And this was a way that seem to help you in some instances. So there's odd to say, but there are some strengths in some of these things that create a help. The problem is it's not the right one. There are people that want to help and saying party, 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 great. It helps get rid of all these other things, and they're helping, but they're missing some of the other pieces. And that's the challenge. When you take that stigma away, saying, look, you need help and the drinking's part of the problem now, and we need to talk about that, rather than saying, oh, it makes the problem go away from me right now. So I feel better. I feel safe. Okay.
And that's where stigma really gets in the way. It's the ones that are harmful and the ones that, you know, maybe are not quite so noxious, but it really keeps us thinking that we're all the same in some way. Mm-hmm. When in reality, these are the way our brains and our bodies work and what we need to be healthy and stable is a person by person, family by family.
Absolutely. Thing. I could take a drink tomorrow and never take a drink again. I could take a drink tomorrow and end up an alcoholic three years from now, and in recovery 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. There's no way of knowing. You have to. It is such an individual disease. All of these. Mm-hmm. It's not like a broken bone. I go to the hospital with a broken bone, and they put it back and they put a cast on me. Hannah goes with a broken bone, they put it back together and put a cast on her. They don't go, oh, so you have a history of being a fisherman, and you have a history of alcohol, so we're going to have to put your bone back together this way. It's not the same with brain diseases. It is a very individualized disease.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stigma affect not just people who have a disease or who are susceptible to it, but, you know, the entire community?
Well, when we say that stigma is a barrier to care, that's not just the person struggling. It's their family. It's the people in the community that are also suffering trauma as a result of addiction. Families go through an incredible amount of challenges when they're trying to help or deal with a loved one that has a mental illness or an addiction disease. So when they feel a stigma, they also have trouble reaching out and finding help for their immediate needs.
That's a good point, because most diseases, when they reach a really late stage, have a huge impact on the family around you. They don't necessarily have the same impact on the community. A lot of things that result from mental illness or substance abuse disorders then start to impact the community. And that's a hard one. Because a person that gets their house robbed by someone in the middle of a schizophrenic episode does not feel compassion for the person that robbed them. And I don't blame them. You have your right to have your home be a safe place. And to have someone with exacerbated symptoms come in and scare you and do things to your house does not feel good. So how do you reconcile those two positions, taking care of community and taking care of the individual? And that's a challenge. There are certainly models around the country of police working together with mental health professionals, police working with substance abuse professionals to recognize opportunities to intervene. And I think if you can move in that direction, it doesn't stop the bad things from happening. It improves the recovery process, and then eventually the bad things stop happening. And that's sort of the goal, to move in that direction, understanding that it's not going to happen tomorrow. There's not like a we can do that make things stop, but it has to be it's a process in moving that way. You're nodding.
Yeah, and I think, too, that there's an assumption that acting with compassion and early intervention and providing resources for help means that we're getting rid of the concept of consequences for our actions or accountability. And that's not true. I think we can have both. I think we can have accountability for how we interact with people and also provide compassionate help.
Yeah, you have to, because you cannot just say rules don't apply to this group of people. Mm-hmm. Community rules still apply to everybody. If your symptoms cause you to overstep those rules, there are consequences. At the same time, there needs to be treatment so those symptoms don't reoccur, because then that's devastating to a community. If you have groups of people in a community that continue to perpetrate crime, issues, social problems, because their symptoms are not met, then there's a big problem.
How do you feel that Homer is doing with stigma, where it's at, and has it changed recently in terms of more understanding about these diseases?
Well, I think that there are a lot of great dialogues happening in the community right now in different niches. I think we've also seen that we have, we are going through that awkward place of trying to talk about it and trying to create more resources in our community with a very difficult subject.
Yeah, I've only been in Homer for a year and a half now, so I'm not sure where we were before I got here. I will tell you that I've been very impressed with the community's response to to my conversations I've had with individuals and groups, there is definitely an awareness that it is a disease, that these are symptoms we're talking about, and these are people we're talking about. I think part of that is the strength of a small community, that there is an understanding that we're all people, and that the person you know is actually a person you know. It's not some person. I moved here from Southern California, and you drive past millions of people that you will never know. In Homer, you know somebody, or you know the person that knows the person. And so it's easier to have some compassion, empathy for those people. And I think that is a strength of our community, absolutely. I've been very impressed. We had some movies that we showed over this winter to help start this discussion and have some interaction with the community about mental illness and substance use. And we had 70 people, and 160 people show up to those movies and listen and talk and share. And just the fact that people showed up from the community to listen to us talk a little bit was a huge message to me, I think. It really indicated that this is a community that is aware of the problem and willing to talk about the problem.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've lived most of my life in Homer. I was born and raised here, and I also participate in quite a few community events. So when I am going to these things and seeing people I don't know show up,
absolutely,
that are curious, that have questions, that are uncomfortable, but they're still there, that tells me that the community is really hungry for that conversation, and they want to try to do something about it that's different.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Does the size of Homer have an impact at all on how people feel the stigma or the willingness to get help? And talking about, you know, sometimes in a small community there can be a lack of anonymity, so people might know more about you. You know, do you see that effect at all in terms of how people feel about, you know, coming out as, you know, having a disease or...
Yeah, Jay's laughing because I was nodding my head emphatically. That's a huge barrier. And once again, you know, I can say I got in my own way for a number of years because of how embarrassed I was. This is the town that I grew up in, the town that I love and that raised me, and I didn't want them to know, you know.
And the thing that I was just citing as a strength, the small town, is also that same thing because everybody knew.
Right.
You know, Hannah, we know. But that there's a little bit more familial component to that. So everyone just said, oh, Hannah's that. That's the way Hannah is. Mm-hmm. And no one offered help. They just sort of worked around it. And it's a small enough community that you can do that. And everyone smiles and nods and works around Hannah.
As an example.
Or me. But that's a perfect example how that strength can then be that barrier at the same time. The right. thing that everyone knows and shares, the small town strength, is also the thing that prohibits you from seeking the help.
But I will say, once you get past that point, it's such a huge relief and you realized you were creating. I mean, I think there's probably, you know, very difficult conversations you have to have in the process of recovery. I'm not saying that's not true. But when I was able to be honest, what I discovered were endless people that could relate to my story. People all over the community that were strong and smart and kind, and people that were still really struggling, but we were all struggling with the same thing. And I found an incredible amount of compassion and understanding. So some of my fears, you know, were not realized. Yeah, I had to have some very challenging conversations when I admitted that I needed to quit drinking and needed help with it. But they were well worth it and resulted in some amazing kind of revelations about my community.
I think you make a great point, Hannah, and I don't want to whitewash how difficult these diseases are.
Absolutely.
And it's easy for us to sit here and talk. You're in recovery for a long time. I've worked in the field for a long time. The emotional toll the diseases take on people when they reach a level, stage five, is rough. It's rough on families, it's rough on communities, which is why destigmatizing the diseases and getting that early help is so important. Because if you're taking care of it earlier, when it arises to a level of crisis or need, you're much better prepared to deal with it emotionally and physically, and it makes the recovery process go much more smoothly. When it comes out of nowhere, and I'm making finger quotes around nowhere, that's when it can be very hard and damaging. So I don't want us to sound like, oh, mental illness, everything. Oh, substance abuse, it's fine. It's not. They are damaging diseases. Managed well, they're just another disease.
Mm-hmm. And we do have an email from a listener that says there are hundreds of people in recovery from substance abuse in Homer, and we meet every day to share our experience, strength, and hope and the joy of life without alcohol or drugs. You can find local AA meetings online at aa.org. And we can talk more about recovery resources, but let's take a quick break and listen to some music. And if you do want to join the conversation when we come back, you can call 235-7721 or you can email info@kbbi.org. Good morning. You're listening to Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. We're talking today about stigma surrounding mental illness and substance abuse. And we have a caller, Troy. Welcome. Tell us your thoughts. And we're having a little bit of technical difficulties.
Tell Troy to try to call back.
Troy, can you try to call back? Oh, hey, we can hear you.
Oh, yeah, you're breaking up quite a bit. Yeah, I'm a Vietnam-era PTSD victim, and talk about stigma. I'm in a group that is...
Double whammy.
...well-known for denying it for the first 40 years, and then having an episode that finally brought it out.
How have you found help for that?
Oh yes, there's a lot of help, and it's basically the Vet Center, which is a reintegration arm of the VA. Their sole mission is to reintegrate the combat vet into society, and they get it, and they are very, very good at what they do.
That's good to hear. And I think it's important.
And you're breaking up so bad, I'm going to have to hang up and listen online. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy.
I think, you know, Troy brings up a great point, is that often one of those same stigmas and barriers to care and to help that we see is trauma of all different shapes and sizes.
Sure. I can't imagine going to battle. I struggle getting up in the morning. I can't imagine getting up with wet socks and knowing that someone's on the other side of a tree waiting to kill you. So I absolutely have empathy for that. It's remarkable. And then to come home and have to struggle with that and live with that. And I'm glad he found support, because there are avenues of support. The email that you got beforehand as well, there's the VA for support. There are all sorts of substance use groups in town. There are family support groups in town, at the local churches. Anything you can do to get that support is the important piece, mm-hmm. because once you start talking with people about it, and like Hannah mentioned earlier, and you find there are other people sitting in the same boat you are, it makes your life better immediately. It doesn't cure everything, but it helps you start to get through that process. So thanks for calling, Troy. It's a really good point. And finding those support systems is the important piece that we're talking about today, and not feeling bad about doing so.
That's right. You know, and I think that reminds me too about this concept of strength. You know, whether you are a soldier, whether that's just a gender identity, or a fisherman, for me, that's one of my places of strength, you know, an Alaskan. There's all these concepts of strength that make us feel like we're supposed to be stronger than our disease. You know, but I was a soldier, but I'm a fisherman. I'm supposed to be but bigger than this and better than this. And I think there's ways, too, we can kind of shift that dialogue to see, you know, the choice of recovery as a strength as well. And part of the ways that we identify as strong. But that can be a really challenging thing in our culture.
Yeah.
And how can you navigate, you know, all the recovery resources that are here that you might not know about, that you might be new to, if you're just sort of wanting help? What's the best way to sort of go about what you need?
That there are some challenges, certainly. The easiest and most basic thing to do is talk to your doctor. Start there. If you do not have insurance, there are clinics in town you can go to and talk to the clinicians there. You can always walk into our agency. There are a number of health agencies in the community. Just walk in and say, I need a little help. And they can help you get that directed where you need to go. If you do have a primary care physician, start there. Absolutely start there with a regular conversation about your mental health needs or your substance abuse needs.
And, you know, the email we had for one of the listeners that pointed out the support groups, that is a great resource. You know, for me, that was the changing step that I took was walking into an AA meeting. And that provided an unbelievable amount of support for me. That was my choice and where I found help. But, you know, finding other people going through it and telling the truth can often make you feel kind of empowered enough to then go seek out the other help that you might need medically and professionally.
Right. And talking a lot about stigma, but what other barriers are there to getting help? I mean, you mentioned, you know, insurance, but are there other barriers that we should be talking about here to getting help?
Yeah, there are a number of barriers. I think that the money piece is certainly one. People's like, oh, I don't have insurance or I don't have access. That's always going to be a challenge. The previous administration, the Obama administration, put some plans in place to help people. The current administration, the Trump administration, has put some plans in place to help with substance abuse. So I think at the federal level, regardless of affiliation, there is movement towards making access to services easier. The government recognizes that this is a problem, and that's good news. Regardless of your identity, you can get help. There's still the problem of stigma of saying, I need the help. And that's always the challenge. Just finding a building to walk into and saying, I need help is hard. And that's probably harder than actually getting the services once you walk in the building. Okay. Hannah, did you have any thoughts?
Just that often the financial cost of getting help or the perceived financial cost, because we're afraid to ask the question. And so there's this story I think we tell ourselves about how much it will cost us. Mm-hmm. And it can be really expensive. And that's a huge barrier as well.
And we can talk more about that, but let's take a call from Paul. Paul, welcome. Tell us your thoughts.
Oh, good morning. This is Paul Seaton, and I just wanted to call in and say I really appreciated the program, but I also, you know, Alaska has so many problems, whether we're talking about drug abuse or any of the other things that are occurring up here, and yet, you know, kind of the highest in the nation in a lot of physical attributes, as negative ones, as well as diseases, as well as mental ones. And, you know, for 7 months out of the year, as everybody has probably heard me say, the research shows that, 90% of people get their vitamin D from sunshine, and for 7 months out of the year, we can't make any up here. And
is this Paul Seaton?
The Department of Defense coming out and their study showing that if you have low vitamin D, you're twice as likely to commit suicide. And you've got all the depression studies that have come out that showed low vitamin D has much higher rates of depression and anxiety. And that's in adolescents as well as adults. And so I guess overcoming that medical problem is something that I worry about not taking care of. So anyway, just wanted to ask what's happening that with the drug abuse crisis as well, and those issues. So anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Seaton.
You know, that's the first time I've ever heard him say that. I'm kidding. No, but he brings up a really good point. And while vitamin D is a component, and I certainly think living in Alaska, he's handed me some reading on it. I was absolutely surprised by the difference in the lower 48 and the Arctic states or areas. Vitamin D is a crucial component. I would also argue that your diet, your exercise, your other health components are as important as well. And so talking to your doctor, talk to your doctor. Get those blood tests. Get some blood work. See what your deficiencies are, because any of those physiological deficiencies can then impact your mental well-being as well. So vitamin D is a wonderful component, and it's certainly worth looking into with your doctor. They're prescription free. You can get them over the counter, pop a few, make you feel better. Hannah?
And those are great preventative and palliative steps to take, but don't let that stop you from getting significant help and intervention if your life is in chaos. You know, I think a lot of times we are past the point of vitamin D. That's always a good thing to do, and I think it has some unbelievable health benefits, but don't want to kind of miss some of the larger risk factors mm-hmm. that we have there.
Are there rehab centers in Alaska?
There are. There's one in Kenai, relatively newly opened. There are a few up in Anchorage. I think there's one in Juneau, but I'm not 100%. I'm still learning some of these things. But there's a very newly opened one up in Kenai. Certainly here in Homer, our agency, Cicada, are both in the area, and they provide rehab support. And then there are the number of support groups around town as well.
But the actual, you know, physical places that you can go and residences, like rehab residences, are very limited in Alaska.
I'm sorry. You're right. Yeah. The residential rehab is, are there any in Alaska? I'm not aware of any in Alaska. I'm aware of rehab programs, but not a residential. I think most people that are looking for residential rehab are looking out of state.
That's one of the big struggles I've heard from family members too, that, you know, they might have someone in their family that's, you know, ready for that next step, but they are then going through the unbelievable hurdle of getting them to California to a rehab that is suitable for their needs.
There's where you want to go for rehab.
Yeah, it's tough.
Let's tell folks where they can go for help specifically. Do you have an address for South Peninsula Health Services?
They're the hospital. Everyone knows the hospital is. The hospital is a resource. Our agency, South Peninsula Behavioral Health, over on Ben Walters is a resource. Cicada is a resource over on Ocean Avenue. There are numerous private therapists in town that, while may not be certified as alcohol or rehab professional, are certainly a resource. They're certainly a mental health resource. There's Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic. It's a resource. There's Haven House. It's a resource. There's SVT. It's a resource. All of these things are places you can go to start the conversation. Mm-hmm. And there's the food bank. I could go on. There are plenty of places to walk in and say, I need help. And then they will help you find where you need to go. That'd be my recommendation.
Definitely. I think that's great. There's so many more resources than we realize, I think. Often you just find somebody in healthcare to tell your truth to and get you to that right next step. And then, of course, the support groups that we already mentioned.
So we have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about what community members can do here to decrease stigma.
Hannah?
I'm going to go back to the thing we've talked about a couple of times, which is being honest, not being afraid to tell your story. Yeah. And stand in what's right for you. You know, when I show up to a party and turn down a drink, I'm cool with that now. But that can be really hard. That can be daunting for some people. But that's okay to do, you know. Do what's right for your health in the moment and not necessarily the story of the rest of the society, but what that stigma is telling us.
Yeah, I think that's about as well as can be said.
Moving forward, what do you both hope to see in Homer when it comes to addressing these diseases?
I would think more globally than that, not just Homer. I would think Alaska, the United States, and the world. I would hope that these diseases 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are discussed the same way AIDS or cancer are discussed, as a treatable, manageable disease that sometimes you can get better from, sometimes you're going to have long-term recovery, sometimes you have lifelong recovery. And that recovery is going to look different for each person, and sometimes it's going to be med-assisted, sometimes it's going to be therapy-assisted, sometimes it's going to be a combination of those things. But that the bottom line is, you live a normal, happy, productive life with a disease, like millions of people in this country do day to day.
Yeah, I think that I want to see a combination of, celebrating recovery and the life that can offer.
Well, that's good.
That's personally what I want to see in my community, is an avenue for that. And I also want to see widespread compassionate intervention for people that are often at their worst and struggling. I think that there's there's great things being done and a long way we can go to improve that.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much, Hannah and Jay.
Thanks, Renee.
From the Bearded Sister and South Peninsula Behavioral Health Services for joining me today. Really appreciate it. You're listening to KBBI AM 890 Homer. This is The Coffee Table. And I'm Renee Gross.